Got it down, good to go. Cool. So tonight I wanted to talk about one of the path factors in the core teachings of the Buddha. If you're coming maybe for the first time in Theravada in Buddhism, sometimes call us list worshippers. When looking at the teachings of the Buddha, they're often outlined as they're recorded in the Pali Canon, which is the main collective discourses that the Buddha gave during his life, in lists, right? These kind of, sometimes they call this like the Dharma map, which I really like because I'm a over planner and organizer, and I like to have all the lists and the things and the map. So the main list, kind of the core of the Buddha's teaching, is known as the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, which actually is not so much a list as it is an outline for practice. That's the weird thing about Buddhism, at least as I understand it and relate to it, is that it's a practice-oriented religion. It's not a dogmatic-oriented religion, which we're used to in the West. It's belief-centric devotion. And so part of the path of the Buddha's teaching is kind of broken into three sections. There's kind of the wisdom section that includes view, our view of the world, this practice of understanding our perception of things and how we view things. We kind of need to keep that in check, right? We see how perceptions can get us in trouble a lot of the time. Sometimes I meet someone and I don't so much like them, right? And then, of course, they're like my best friend 3 years later, right? We can be really biased, that our view is really, it's a strong thing of our views and our opinions, our beliefs, right? We see this rampant in our culture, in all cultures, but it's pretty easy to see, especially during a political season, views and opinions. And so view and intention, so also the Buddha really emphasized intention of, you know, what he says is whatever we think and ponder upon becomes the inclination of our mind, so that we create mental habits through choice, basically, that we have some opportunity to intervene by setting an intention, like we did at the beginning of the meditation. We're going to put aside the plans. We're going to put aside the past, put aside the future, knowing that it's going to come right back, but the intention's there, right? And that can become the ground of our practice. Oh, not right now. I'm going to put that aside again. I'm going to put that aside. And so view and intention make up the, as a collection, what we would call the wisdom practices of the Eightfold Path. And then speech, action, and livelihood. Buddhism is indeed an engaged practice, so not just sitting quietly, closing the eyes, looking internally, but also where most of my stress and suffering is created is in relationships and conflict and communication and what I do for work, right? And so speech, action, and livelihood are a part of the path, and this is called sila, or ethical training, which I really like because there aren't so many moral judgments about what's good or bad or right or wrong, but more so these are really good grounds for practicing principles, you know, practicing, you know, compassion, forgiveness, appreciation, equanimity. And then the last section, so we have wisdom, we have sila, or the ethical trainings, and then the last section is called bhavana, or actually called samadhi, or these are where you get the meditative practices. It includes effort, mindfulness, and concentration. We flip the Eightfold Path on its head in the West, and we start with meditation, and we, if we're lucky, we get to the ethical training, right? Is usually we find our way, as I did, at least I found my way in here because I wanted to meditate, not because I wanted to be more careful about how I speak or consider my livelihood, right? So we usually start with the meditative part of the path, which I think is fine. It's just interesting because it's really the Buddha emphasized meditation much later on in teaching to people. You know, people come to him and say, hey, I'm really suffering, I'm really stressed, I'm really having an existential crisis, midlife crisis, what do I do? And he would say, do service, be generous. I guarantee you will not feel like shit if you're of service, right? And this is, you know, this is helpful because, and we learn this even in Western psychology, a lot of times, like with dialectical behavioral therapy and cognitive behavioral therapy, all these behavioral therapies, we know that if we can start to change our behavior, our moods and emotions and mind states will also regulate to some degree. So I think that's kind of genius. Also, I'm in 12-step recovery and have been for 10 years, and they do the same thing. So when you come into like a 12-step recovery program, the first thing that you stop doing is getting high, unfortunately. And then, you know, stop lying and cheating and stealing and being dishonest and manipulating. You tune up your behaviors, and then you start really working on personal inventory, you know, what I'm not too fond of the term, but like they call character defects, or looking at our liabilities comes later. This inquiry, this insight, this you know, what we look for in meditation. So I'm always interested in, like, why would one want to meditate? And when I reflect on why I wanted to meditate, it was because I felt like there would be some sense of ease or tranquility or peace. These are words that I hear often associated with meditation: stillness, clearing the mind. It's kind of a weird paradox, because at one end I felt like I received that very early on in my meditation practice, but at the same time I confronted a lot of the opposite. Like, I would sit down and try to meditate, and all I came into contact with was what the Buddha calls the monkey mind, right? The chatter and the you know, the self-criticism and the doubt and the anticipation and the wanting and the it can be kind of actually frustrating a little bit to try to practice, because we're coming into contact with the habit of the mind. You know, if I live my life and I'm busy and I'm stressed and I'm doing a million things a minute, and then I try to sit down, that's what I get. I get that mind that's really been practicing that. So the aim of, I'm always wary about saying like the goal or the aim of something, but I think the goal or the aim of bhavana, or this cultivation, right, because the word meditation actually comes from a Christian context and much later, but cultivation, the aim is to start to uproot our compulsive thinking and afflictive emotional patterns by familiarizing ourselves with them. Does that make sense? So, like, to start to see more clearly how our compulsive, kind of obsessive tendencies of mind and the afflictive emotions that come with them, how they affect us and how they create stress in our lives. You know, and there's no moral judgment of this, like I'm doing it right or doing it wrong, but we start to, actually quite the opposite, and cultivating mindfulness, we take this objective stance on the whole thing of just watching like an observer, Right now, it's like this. Oh, there's shame here. What does that feel like? What is that like? And so mindfulness is really the vehicle in which we uproot suffering. Suffering's a strong word. Stress, obsession, dis-ease, discomfort. Mindfulness asks the questions, how does this feeling, how is this feeling, what caused this feeling, what triggers this feeling, and what leads to its release? It inquires, it's investigative, it's curious, it's contemplative in that way. I like the definition of mindfulness as the ability to objectively monitor the arising and passing of thoughts, feelings, and emotions within present time awareness. So the ability to objectively monitor the arising and passing of thoughts, feelings, and emotions within the present time awareness. And so we're taking this non-judgmental kind of vantage point where we can observe and ask those questions. What is it like now? What is it like now? How is it now? Oh, how does this affect you now? How does this trigger you now? What is this like now, right? Mindfulness guides us towards what we would call, it's not a very common word in our vocabulary, equanimity, which is, it means there in the middleness, or this kind of balanced capacity to hold and to be with something that maybe would cause distress or would maybe cause clinging, or to be able to behold and to be with something enough to investigate, enough to question, to inquire. And the hard thing about mindfulness practice is that we're using the faculty of the mind to observe the mind. It's the weirdest thing, right? In one way, it's the simplest thing ever. Like, sometimes I wonder why I even have a job, right? It's like, I can't believe people pay me to come and, like, have them sit and pay attention to their breath, right? It's like the most ordinary, simple thing. In another way, it's incredibly challenging to navigate from an experiential, from just my personal sitting practice, right, for a long time, and also to talk about and to teach and to consider, because we're using attention to observe what's happening, right? What's happening in, when I say mind, in Buddhism we talk about this word citta, which means heart-mind. So heart and mind are used interchangeably. So the emotional, mental experience. We're using the attention to look right back at it. And in order to do this, we need to be able to train our attention. Mindfulness is ultimately, it's a science of attention training. And we do this through samadhi. So we use samadhi and mindfulness. I'll talk about samadhi. We use samadhi and mindfulness together. I actually don't feel, and I'll talk about this some too, but there are a lot of different views and opinions about how to develop concentration, which is samadhi, and how to develop insight, which is vipassana, or where we would use mindfulness. How much concentration do you need? How much do you just do insight practice? And really, I don't see that. I mean, they're mutually inclusive. You need them both, right? They lean on each other. And so I like to use some of the Pali Sanskrit words in talking, because there aren't really great translations for a lot of these, and one of these in particular is the word samadhi. We've usually translated this to mean concentration, but I found this to be really problematic in our culture because we have this achievement mentality. I know that I have it for sure. So, like, when I think concentration, I first think, I'm no fucking good at that, right? That's my first thought. You know, if I had to go, and honestly, if I had to go into a room full of people and, you know, some of these mental health groups that I facilitate or treatment centers and say, okay, I'm going to teach you guys how to concentrate first, people would be like, no way, right? I'm not doing that. One, I'm no good at it. Two, it sounds boring, right? But what samadhi really means is it means collectedness of awareness. It means sometimes unification of the mind or stillness. And so that's sounding a little bit better than concentration, maybe. Samadhi, the result of collecting the awareness into the breath like we did tonight and continuing that practice, actually brings a lot of joy. It brings stillness. It brings ease. As a matter of fact, most of the time when we would say, you know, we always say there's no right or wrong way to meditate, but at the end of the meditation, I always check in with folks and it's like, oh, I had a good meditation today, I had a bad meditation today. And when we say good meditation, most of the time we mean we were very concentrated. It felt good because our mind was still, it was unified. We felt like we were able to connect and sustain our attention with breathing. And so the plans and the thoughts and all this stuff that normally occupies the mind actually was able to fall away. I like describing samadhi as, or this part of mindfulness practice, because again, it's not separate, it's together. Samadhi as like if you're reading a book and your friend's in the other room watching TV, right? And if you're like me, you have, you know, diagnosable ADD, and so you're like, listening to the TV and not really reading the book, but let's just pretend, right? And this is actually important because you can actually train attention, right? We know this in neuroscience, you can train attention. And so samadhi is like where you are reading a book and your friend's in the other room watching TV and you can hear the TV, it's there, it's the sound is available, but your attention is on the content of what you're reading, right? And sometimes, you know, let's say you're reading a really good book, it's so much to where the attention of what you're reading comes completely to the foreground of your awareness and the TV falls away. You don't really, it's not, you know, you don't pay attention to it because the attention can actually unify, it can collect. And so first we start practicing this part of mindfulness, samadhi, by setting an intention like we did tonight. You know, this is the foundation of any meditation practice is committing and saying, okay, I'm going to sit for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, or 30 like we did tonight. I'm going to sit, I'm going to put aside all the stuff. I promise it will be there later, I'll do it later, but right now I'm going to really set this intention. As the Buddha says in the discourse on mindfulness, he says to set aside your desire and discontent in regard to the world. All the shit that we want and that we don't want about our lives and the world, he says to set it aside for this time, you know. Setting that intention. Because in order to see the mind clearly and start to do this insight practice where we start to familiarize ourselves with the compulsive thinking, the afflictive emotions, and the stress, and get to know it and see what triggers it and see what, you know, how it makes us feel and how we can relieve it. In order to do that, we need to break the addiction to the mind, right? In order to use the mind, to be aware of the mind, we need to first, like, break the addiction to it. And this is where I really like, you know, the phrase, and I use this sometimes even when I'm sitting, is I'll just tell my mind, not right now. Not right now. Not right now. And we do this gently because the tendency is to try to concentrate, not to collect the awareness. The tendency is to strive. you know, and to really effort and to really try to exhaust ourselves to find and pin down the breath. And this is bad news because the breath isn't a noun, it's a verb, right? Breathing is an active thing, it's happening, so you're never going to be able to pin it down, right? It's just the practice of coming back. Oh, can I feel it? And then you can start to sense into, oh, there's the beginning, right? There's the swelling of the stomach, the expanding of the stomach. There's the pause, there's the beginning of the exhale. You can even get so concentrated where you don't really find distinguished boundaries between the inhale and the exhale. So setting this intention is where we start breaking the addiction in the mind. And then what we want to do is we want to start to connect and sustain attention. During the sit tonight, I offered three anchors that we can bring our attention to do mind or to practice mindfulness of breathing. Traditionally, one of the most common techniques is to bring attention to the air sensation at the nostrils, or the mouth, the feeling of air. I suggest that out of any of these, it really doesn't matter. It's just to investigate and to see what works and what feels easiest to connect with. So there's the nostrils. There's sometimes if you get caught up in restlessness or you're striving and you're trying to find it and you just keep thinking a lot, sometimes what I'll do is I'll drop my attention into the rise and fall of my stomach. Sometimes I'll even place my hand on my stomach just to feel what it's like to breathe. And then also even widening further back and just feeling breathing in the bodily form. What is breathing? You know, even noticing as I breathe, maybe the body leans a little bit, right? When I breathe in and it kind of, as it contracts, it maybe comes together a little more, and feeling the whole space of the body as you're breathing. I like to say breathing from the bottom of your feet to the top of your head and the top of the head to the bottom of the feet. So we make adjustments. This is what's cool about meditation, is that it's creative almost. Not too creative. But it is a little bit, because sometimes when I'm feeling pressure and I'm feeling like I'm really trying to find the fucking breath, right? What I'll do is I move from this kind of nostril, really close feeling, and I'll just expand into the wider sense of my body sitting. You know, I'll feel my body, I'll feel, you know, the sensation of air as it comes and enters, or as it enters and exits the body. You know, and sometimes I'm a little lax, I'm a little lazy, and I'll encourage myself to be a little more on top of it, a little more, oh, let's find a point and stay there. I'm also actually a big fan of using labeling, like I offered tonight too, of breathing in, just using the label in on the in-breath, using the label out on the out-breath. Some people choose to count breathing as a way, as a marker to come back. The most important thing in the Buddha's instruction, he didn't talk about counting, he didn't talk about labeling to my knowledge, but what he did talk about is to feel and to know the breath. So he was very clear that what we're trying to do is to feel the physical sense. We're trying to connect to the breath through the body, through feeling. Not just conceptually, am I there or am I not? It's can I feel this next in-breath? So we traditionally, breathing is a very common object of being able to break the addiction of the mind, of being able to steady and stabilize the mind, of practicing samadhi. You can also use metta practice if you know what that is, as we practice heart practices here, and they're almost cultivating these positive emotional states, kindness, forgiveness, compassion, appreciation. right? Because as we develop insight and we start to see the afflictive emotions and compulsive thinking, it's not just enough to be aware, right? Awareness, I always say, is bad news. It's good, I mean, it's important, and we need to be aware, but we also need to learn to respond, right? Internally, oh, may I be at ease with this right now? This is really challenging. Oh, wow, there's a lot of anxiety in my nervous system. I really feel wired. You know, may I be at ease? Can I soften? Can I open? May I be kind? May I be gentle with myself? So what we do usually is we'll offer phrases, and offering these phrases, you know, in popular terminology, some may call this a mantra. But we offer these phrases, and coming back to these phrases is also we're developing that concentration, that collectedness of awareness. It's something to come back to. Oh, my mind's off in tomorrow. I'm planning about my job, and I'm worrying about this thing I might forget. Oh, may I be at ease? I'm going to come back to that phrase and feel that. Walking meditation is one of my favorite alternatives to just sitting. And, you know, I just spent a lot of time on retreat, and it can be quite excruciating to just do sitting meditation all day, you know. And so walking and feeling the lifting, moving, placing of the feet, the sensation, the gravity, the movement of the body, the distribution of weight, and doing that as a practice really helps build concentration too. And I love this because it's practical, right? Like, even as I leave here and I go out into my busy life, I can just, as I'm walking to my car, right, on my lunch break or whatever, just feel into my feet, remember the ground, remember that I'm here, right? It's what I forget more than anything else, is that I'm here. I'm not where my mind says that I am. So we're not so much putting attention on the object or breathing in this case. We're not so much as we are breathing or opening our attention to breathing, right? So it's not so much like I feel like I'm pinning down or placing, but I'm opening my attention to feel what's already here. As long as I'm alive, I'm breathing, right? And so I get to kind of expand and have this more gentle approach, this more soft approach, instead of trying to find it, you know, kind of almost settling back and being open to, oh, there's breathing here. I talked about this during the instruction, giving ourselves enough time and enough space. Oh, there's plenty of time to, you know, being patient. There's plenty of time to develop this. I don't need to get it. So setting an intention, and then second, connecting and sustaining attention. And the third thing that samadhi really helps us do is to what they call a sense restraint, or guarding the senses. You know, a huge part of the gift that I've gotten from mindfulness is being able to see when my mind's starting to go into some crazy shit, like I'm about to trip, right? And I just say, like, not right now, right? Or I just say, no, not going to do that. I'm going to come back, right? And almost guarding, using mindfulness as a guardian, and this is one of the ways that the Buddha talks about mindfulness, definitely not the only way, but one of the ways is to guard ourselves from, you know, once I let it in, right, and I just sit here and chew on the resentment for a little while, it's going to be really hard to break free from that, right? Because I love some blame and some drama and some gossip. Like, once that gets in, it's like, you know, I'm having a field day with it. You know, so if I can start to notice that the attention's heading in that direction, and it's starting, oh, it's like, oh, a little blame, a little, oh yeah, it was kind of their fault, wasn't it? And you know, I can kind of see that sometimes and reel it back in and say, all right, what's really happening now? shit, I don't actually feel, I feel embarrassed this person called me out, or I feel insecure, or I feel, you know, and then coming back into the body and back into the breath and allowing myself to, right, dive into the emotion, into the body, into the physical nervous system, instead of feeding the nervous system. The nervous system's like an electrical unit. I can tend to just pour more stuff into the feedback loop, right? And then I'm all ramped up. So guarding and being really careful, the Buddha encouraged us to be really careful about where we put our attention. In neuroscience, we know whatever we pay attention to gets magnified. It gets bigger. The word for attention, manasikaro in Pali Sanskrit, means making in the mind. So whatever we pay attention to gets made in the mind. And so we want to just be a little bit careful. I want to speak to the flip side of this. So guarding sense restraint, guarding the mind. The other tendency, I heard this from my friend the other day, is this bypassana strategy, or the spiritual bypass, where we can kind of have a tendency to repress or to cut off or to almost avoid conflict, emotional distress, internal feelings of shame or guilt or criticism, all of this uncomfortable shit through concentration practice. No, not right now, breathe. No, not right now, breathe. No, not right now, breathe, right? And we can kind of like, what I really love about the archetypal story of the Buddha is that he actually did this. Before his awakening in the story of the Buddha, he mastered concentration meditations, which he didn't make up. This was just a part of what helped and assisted his awakening. But he say all he did was sit and learn to quiet the mind, just collect the attention, to breathe, to really pay attention, get in these states of really feeling absorbed, like shut off from the world. It brought immense joy and bliss. Right, but he didn't have any mindfulness of this quality of how is this, what is this, of being able to confront and to look into the stress and the obsession, the suffering. He was just ignoring the mind. Right, so we only ignore the mind or break the addiction of the mind and come to our anchor enough so we can gain enough space to then look at it. Right? So setting an intention, connecting, sustaining, guarding the senses. And then the fourth way that we then use samadhi or concentration, collectedness of awareness, is to start to develop insight. Like I said, of getting enough space so we can start to actually then move into these other foundations of mindfulness. So breathing is a part of the first foundation, which is the body. Just really, and we never graduate from breathing in the body. The foundations aren't like you graduate to the next level and then you don't go back, right? They're like fields or pastures. So we breathe and body, and then we can start to investigate and use mindfulness to look at feeling. We can use mindfulness to then look at the mind itself. What's my perception of this person? What's my attitude? How is that creating? How is clinging to this view creating suffering right now? How is wanting things to be different creating suffering? How is identifying with my current condition? I'm no good. I'll never have the job. I'll never have the girl. I'm just inherently a piece of shit. I've always, you know, how is that type of identification, this fixed version of myself, self-criticism causing suffering? And so then we use mindfulness to start, or we use this samadhi to then look and to have, investigate and to develop some insight. So just briefly, I want to, talk talk about the, or kind of even review a little bit, the some of the pros and cons? And concentration and really developing closeness to breathing and being able to, you know, as we go and as we continue to practice, we do, I found in my experience, have more capacity and more ability to concentrate and to connect and sustain attention with breathing. You know, I could maybe get like 3 or 4 breaths an entire meditation when I started. You know, and I remember actually being an undergraduate in college and typing a paper, and I would read a sentence, and I had to reread the sentence and start writing the next sentence, and I had to reread the first sentence and read part of the second sentence and write the rest of the sentence, then I literally would write a whole page. It took me like fucking 8 hours to write like a 4-page paper, you know, because I would just, every time, I actually did that a little bit today, but actually I just had to like read and reread and reread, because I couldn't connect and sustain attention. I was preoccupied with perfection, expectation, all these things, right? And I couldn't just stay with it. And I found that to be drastically different in my life now, as I feel like I can connect and sustain it. I can attune to people I'm having a conversation with and stay in it a little bit now, right? And be able to listen some instead of just preparing what I want to say. Right, that's all thanks to the samadhi of being able to be like, oh, okay, hold on, like, what's happening now? They're still talking, right? They're not done. You know, and being able to do that and being able to write and read. So that's one of the major pros of mindfulness practice and concentration together, is that I've been able to connect and sustain attention. I've been able to train my attention to be more reliable. Also, one of the pros is there is this ability to develop really deep states of absorption, as they call it, jhana practice, or really being able to, especially, I don't so much talk about this a lot here because it's mostly what one would experience on long retreat or extended like silent meditation retreat for a few days and really practicing, right? You kind of create the conditions. You're only eating certain meals, you're not having sex, you're not talking, right? There's a lot of conditions where we can quiet the mind, pay attention to an object, and it actually can become very joyful. And people always ask me, oh, you set that retreat, wasn't that miserable? I'm like, well, some of it, but some of it's actually really enjoyable when I don't have to, you know, when I can actually collect and ground my awareness into breathing and I don't have to stress or plan. And then, of course, some of the cons are spiritual bypass that we talked about. Also clinging to concentration. This happens so subtly in almost everyone's meditation practice. Is, you know, even myself, it's like continuing to practice and calling my teacher and saying, oh, I haven't been concentrated for the past 2 months. I think I've plateaued in my, you know, like I have this linear, you know, that one day I'm going to like get here and stay here. Right? And so I can have this kind of clinging to, oh, I'm not very concentrated, so I must not be making any progress. And the last thing, maybe to cap it off, is that there are a lot of different views on, like I said, how much do we need to break the addiction of the mind and focus on breathing before we can start to then look at these stressful habits. And I really don't feel like you do one before the other. I feel like you do them both at the same time. I think it's somewhat helpful to talk about concentration separate from mindfulness because there are different qualities, and it can help us to notice. Ajahn Chah, who's in our lineage of where this lineage against the stream comes from, Ajahn Chah is a Thai forest master, a Buddhist monk in the Thai forest lineage. He said, you actually want to feel safe and secure in your body. You want to feel at ease. And you want to, with that, with just connecting with the body, concentration will come and insight will come. So he said, you do both at the same time, emphasized a lot more insight than concentration. He was like, "Just you just need a little bit." The Burmese style, where our friend and community member Brian is today, he's studying in Burma for the next 3 months. Good luck to him. The Burmese style is lots of concentration, almost strict, a little bit really, what's happening now, where's your attention now, come back. And there are benefits to both. Because the more concentrated the mind, the more insight. But it's really hard to develop this degree of concentration being a lay person living in the world that we do, so I tend to lean more towards Ajahn Chah's mindfulness in all postures. Sit, you know, commit to sitting, take 5, 10, 15 minutes every day, work your way up to 20, work your way up to 40, come to the sitting group, participate, be a part of it, but go live your life, communicate with people, enjoy it, be mindful as you're working, as you're about to write the shitty email, right? That's where it really helps us a whole lot, you know? So, I know that's quite a bit. Hopefully there's some discussion that can come out of it. We usually just open the floor. If you have questions, that's fine, or comments or anything. The floor is open. Thank you.